Okay, tonight's speaker is actually a product of Laguna Beach sobriety. He now lives in Washington, D.C., but we taught him everything he knows right here in this room. So tonight, let's give a warm welcome to our speaker tonight, Ron from Washington, D.C.
Good evening, I'm Ron, and I'm an alcoholic. And the luckiest alcoholic in the universe. By the grace of God, and a lot of luck, I think I've made every mistake in AA you can make. But I hadn't had to drink since my first meeting. And just sitting there thinking, planning what I was going to say, none of which ever comes out. I was thinking about that first meeting. If you're a newcomer tonight, try to catch this disease, please. It's absolutely the best thing that's ever happened to me. It's the only fatal illness I know that we have in medicine that's 100% treatable, but only about 15% of us get well. And that's the great tragedy in the American medical show. We don't know how to do it different. The purpose of treatment, I think, is to get people to come to these meetings, because the people that keep coming to AA stay sober and have a wonderful life. And you look around this crowd, and it's just it's that beautiful California AA that's so passionate, and I have to call it California Pep Rally AA, you know. I'm Ron, and I'm an alcoholic. And everybody's happy about that. And the most shameful thing I ever did, I think, was stand up in an AA meeting, an East Side Open Door, and say, I'm Ron, and I'm an alcoholic. And they treated that shame right then. They say, yay, Ron, we're glad you're here. And they were. It was the first time I ever felt okay about being an alcoholic. I just love it. Happens to the best people I know. I was just thinking that Dr. Paul back there. Dr. Paul was at my first doctor's AA meeting. Dr. Paul has added way more to my sobriety than he'll ever know, Paul and Max. I always kind of envied Paul. He graduated second in his class at the University of Pittsburgh. I wasn't quite that high. I just always admired him so much and loved him. Chuck L. over there, best anesthesiologist in the universe. This is a room full of winners like you just don't run into. My first AA meeting was December the 6th, 1976, and I went to Eastside Open Door in Long Beach. I didn't go because I was an alcoholic. I went because I was a department head. I had the best job I'd ever had in medicine. I was director of the largest intensive care unit in the federal system. And I stood up and said, I'm Ron, and I'm an alcoholic. And about three speakers into the meeting was Frank Honeycutt down there. And I said, if I can get him for a sponsor, I'll stay sober. And that happened that night, and that's 22 years ago. It just works if you do what they say do. Polly back there. Polly and I go back to Texas, and we had a mutual friend that's dead now, Ray F., and we got into meditation and 11th step and just the joy of sharing early recovery with somebody. You get closer to them than anyone else. John A. back there, another person that's added more to my sobriety than he'll ever know, because he sponsored so many people, and I've heard, well, John says this and John says that. So if you're from a dysfunctional family like I was, you can't complain because your family's here. You can pick the best brothers and sisters and mothers and dads and children in the universe right here in this room, and I guarantee you the brightest. Much of my story has to do with medicine, and I don't apologize for that, because I tried to learn about the disease of alcoholism, so because I knew my family had it, and they were outstanding people that built hydrogen bombs and put men on the moon, and smart, good basically kind, gracious, elegant people that shouldn't drink. And didn't know how not to. So I kind of took that journey. I remember when I was a little boy going into the doctor's office and the smell and the cleanliness and the order and my own psychopathology. I just adhered to that. And I said, well, maybe if I can do that, I can understand, because I knew my dad, one of the best guys I've known, opera singer, grew up listening to him sing on the radio and totally destroyed himself with drinking. And I knew he didn't do it because he wanted to. He did it because he didn't know how not to. So I intellectualized and said, well, what I'll do is go to medical school. And I started out on my journey. It got colorful. I went to the Naval Academy first and failed my flight physical. And I wanted to bomb Vietnamese people like everybody with any chutzpah in our class, and was about 6 weeks before we realized we were on the wrong side of that war over there, and that's the way, one of the ways I ended back up in Washington, because I thought the Gulf War was worth fighting, but I'll get into that later. But I remember coming back to my room, and my roommate who went on to flight school said, he'd just passed his flight physical, and he said, it makes me feel so humble to be so perfect. I wanted to choke him. But I went on. I took my journey, which was to medical school in the University of Texas, and went that route and loved it from the start. Just loved immersing myself. I particularly loved, there were a bunch of pre-meds there, and I was an engineer, and I hadn't had a course in biology, so I loved beating them on exams. I still have that fierce competitive part of me that I'm embarrassed about, but that's who I am. I live in a city that people don't move to Washington for the weather, and they don't move to Washington for the money. And move to Washington for the power. You have to pee on your desk every day to hold on to it. And I'm embarrassed to say that I just love it. I just love everything about it. I learned to love it because I worked for a guy sitting on the front row, Dr. Joe Persh, and I'll break his anonymity because he's not an alcoholic. He's one of the only, probably the only psychiatrist I've ever known who didn't have the disease, who understood it. And I intuitively knew that. I became his student, and I watched the way he walked, and I watched the way he talked, and saw him tell the President of the United States that he couldn't be president unless he did it his way. And I walked out of the room. I said, Captain, you realize what just happened? And he looked at me with those eyes, and he said, those are big chips, son. Doing the right thing and not frightened of the consequences, just telling the truth. Telling the truth. And the people that I have seen that could do that are in this room. My sponsor's probably helped more alcoholics than anybody I know, and he's straight. He just doesn't mince words. He's taught me a lot of things that I didn't want to hear and told me a lot of things that I didn't want to hear. And my life's gotten better and better and better ever since he started talking to me. Because I'm the kind of alcoholic that from time to time loses interest in survival. You know, I just want to quit. I don't want to do the right thing. I should tell you that I'm back in Washington now. Because I quit the Navy. The Navy sent me to medical school and trained me in critical care medicine and internal medicine. I was a real doctor before I became a psychiatrist. And that took a while, but it... but I quit 2 years early. I had a temper tantrum and quit. And... part of my eighth and ninth step, you know, you got to go back and get right with things. And when the Gulf War broke out, and I heard, I got a call and talked to Dr. Persh and talked to my analyst, and I was in the training analysis at the time, and I was making about three times what I'm making now, and I was in Newport Beach, and I was chairman of the department of psychiatry at Hoag Hospital, and I was, the money was good and the time off, and this is the most beautiful weather in the world. And I told my analyst, I said, I didn't think I needed to go back to Washington. And he said something that training analysts shouldn't say. He said, so you're not going to keep your word. You're not going to keep your word. Now, I said, well, where the hell is that in the analyst training manual that you say that to me? You're supposed to be neutral. You lack in empathy from my standpoint. And so I went back. And I went back, and things got good. I spend my days walking again the footsteps, the big ones that have been put down by Joe Persh and others. And I spend my days in the Pentagon and on the Hill and fighting all the while and just loving being there. And I wouldn't be there if I wasn't an alcoholic. None of the doors would have opened had I not had this disease. And that's why I say to the newcomers, if you're a newcomer tonight, please try to catch it. Your life will get wonderful. Not overnight. Not overnight. We have to work on ourselves, and we have to keep working on ourselves. I want to spend a little time on the powerlessness of this disease and how I tried to approach it, and I tried to learn about it. And as I said, I was in medical school at Texas, and got fascinated with it from the start. But incidentally, when I got to my first AA meeting, I knew more about alcoholism than anybody I knew. Not because I was smart or smarter, but because I knew I had a fatal illness. And I had been working in intensive care units, running intensive care units where you got a mortality of 30-40% anyway. And half of those were alcoholics. And I'd gone all the way through medical school, spent time in the Parkland emergency room, and never saw anybody in recovery. And that's terrifying. We've changed that now. Paul and I started it out at Loma Linda, but the medical students now go to a meeting. That's part of the training in psychiatry at the National Naval Medical Center where I teach. You have to go to an AA meeting. Why? Because if you want to learn about diabetes, what do? You look with the diabetics, and you spend time with them. And we figured that two or three trips to an AA meeting was way more than all the lecture nonsense that you do. Because when you walk in the rooms, you see the treatment, you see the outcome, you hear how bad it had gotten, and you have to begin to believe right then. But I got... Can I take this coat off now? My sponsor told me I had to wear it up here, and I, if by your grace, sir, you do what you're told. You don't mess around. But I got quite taken with the disease. I spent a summer at Bethesda. Second trip to Bethesda. The first time I had my face caved in and playing football at the Naval Academy. But the second one, I was back as a doctor, or an extern, what they call it. I spent time in the morgue working on the Kennedy table. That was the table because that's where Kennedy's autopsy had been done or botched up, depending on what you read. And I was cutting up alcoholic brains. I was studying alcoholic, the effect of alcohol on the human brain. I was taking the scalp off and the cranium open and taking the brain out and weighing the brain. And you could see that the grooves of the brain, instead of being together like that, were kind of gaped open. I could write down that it was probably 100, 125 grams less than normal. I would see that it was a little mushier. Why? Because alcohol dissolves the brain. It's not a good and evil issue. It's just the chemical property of alcohol in the brain. It dissolves some other organs too, the ovaries and the testes. A little bit tacky for a short guy like me who's drinking to feel more like a man, to be taking it out of me by drinking, dissolving my brain and my manhood. So I started to learn about it, and I wanted to learn about it. I did my work in the morgue carefully. And that night I'd go to the bachelor officer's quarters and make a decision whether to go back to my room or to the bar, because there was laughter in the bar. And you could hear the glass and the ice and the tinkle, and I'd make a decision whether to go back there and study and with the images I carried from the day, or to the bar. And which one did I make? Always the bar. Was it because I was weak? Did I have a character defect? Was it because I wasn't bright or wasn't trying to learn or unteachable? No, it wasn't all any of those things. So far as I know, it was because an alcoholic. I didn't know how not to do that. I was powerless. That was one of the powerlessness moments of my life. I tell this one, it's we have those gallows laughter about it, but I drinking, I was the kind of alcoholic that was going to die or go to jail quickly. I wasn't going to drink long, and I knew that. I had occasion, the Irving, Texas police had occasion to come to my home. We were having what's called a domestic disturbance. My wife was trying to run over me with a car, and I was trying to prevent that and dissuade her by hanging onto the windshield. And she'd speed up, and I tumbled off, and she sped up. And I might add that that was good judgment on her part that night. But the Irving police came, and I hit one of the policemen. And you don't do that in Texas. It's just poor form. And they filleted my head with one of these nightsticks, and it was open, their blood coming down. And I remember standing there in handcuffs, barefoot in a T-shirt, telling the officer not to take me down to Parkland to get my head sewed up, that I'd already examined it and they could do without stitches. And I was a doctor down there during the day, and I only did this kind of stuff at night. Now that's pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I think that's powerlessness. Nowhere in my high school yearbook have I said, well, in December such and such, I'm going to the Irving, Texas jail for drunk in public. That's the absurdity of it. And then the next day, I got out of jail and I went back to work. And I learned that couldn't smell Valium. I didn't want to smell like an alcoholic physician. And I liked Dexamil a lot. The SEBA guy used to leave Ritalin when we would be studying for exams. It was before what's called a class 4, and he'd leave a case of it, 20 milligram Ritalin. And you'd have to get down there really quick to get a bottle, and we'd sprinkle it on our cereal in the morning. Take the exam and then take some more of it and stay up all night drinking so you could stay up. Chuck, you're laughing, but I know you know. just insanity. And again, not meaning it. Wanting to do the right thing. A few alcoholics get up and say, I'm going to go screw up the universe today. We just don't do it. I mean, a lot of good heart in this program. A lot of good people with very fine values that lose everything because alcohol acts different on our brains than it does other people. And we still don't know how or why. I'm right across from the National Institutes of Health and the NIDA folks, and we're looking and trying to look and finding molecules, and we do dances and burn feathers under the bed and all the other stuff, but basically we haven't found any substitute for this. Thank God, because this is free. And it can span infinitely. I was at the Mayo Clinic, and I remember this because I was married to a wonderful woman, and I came home and there was a Mayflower van in front of the apartment. And it's a sign your marriage is in trouble if that happens to any of you tonight. And I came home and the house was empty. It was one of those Minnesota fall days. And fall is pretty in Minnesota, both days of it. I opened the closet, and one of my sons, he was 2 years old, his shoes tumbled out. And I realized at that moment that alcohol was taking away from me everything that was worthwhile in life, really. Everything that I cared about. This was a terrific lady. I've gotten to know her since. And two of the best boys in the universe. And they were gone. Not because she was a quitter. She just stayed too long at the fair. She just couldn't hang out there anymore. And absolutely did the right thing. I went from there to San Diego and finished a medicine residency and then to a critical care fellowship at SC. And that's the way I begin to fall in love with California. It's the best place in the world to live and the most exciting place and the most beautiful, brightest, most creative people in the world. It's almost like this is the Mecca of AA now. Clancy says that, and it's true. He says that Akron, Ohio is like Bethlehem. Something happened there once that was good and not much since. And, but this is it. You're in, the newcomers tonight, you're in the best AA meeting I've ever been to. And I've been to them in the Antarctic and Paris and London and India and all over the world, Washington and throughout the United States. And to me, because it's my home group, I guess, and because of some of the people I've mentioned, you can stay sober here. Your life can get good here. You can change. You can listen to people around you who will kind of guide you in a loving way, sometimes not so loving, but in a definite way, so you can get new values and you can internalize new values. If you're the kind of alcoholic like me that always kind of wants to take the quick way, you can learn not to do that. You can learn to be thorough and careful and thoughtful of others, because that's not my nature. The capacity for concern for others has been learned in these rooms. You learn it back there making coffee. You learn it up here with the literature. You learn it with service, like Julie. You know, the most magnificent woman I know, except for my wife. And great family. Greg's the best guy in the world, and three beautiful children. I've known her 20 years now and watched that family come up. You can't do that outside of here. Not like that. I need to remember this part, too, and then I want to talk a little bit about sobriety. I got a letter. I was teaching emergency medicine out at Loma Linda, where Chuck and I spent some time, and I got a request for permission to publish a paper from Johns Hopkins Medical School. They published a paper on computers, or a book on computers in medicine. And I said, well, there's a lot of Ron Smith, and they've got the wrong guy, but, you know, I was working in the emergency room. About 1 o'clock at night, I got curious, and I called the librarian, and I said, would you pull this paper? And she pulled it. And I had written it, and it was published. It's Emergency Decision Making in Emergency Medicine. It was published in the Journal of International Electrical Engineering and Machine Intelligence. It's a very fine journal. I wasn't really familiar with it, but it's a good paper. And I tell you that because I don't remember writing it. I don't remember the research. And it would be funny were I not taking care of live human beings those years. I would come to on these LA freeways, you know, when it's right before sunup or after sunrise, and not know whether I'd be going to the hospital or coming from it. And that's the kind of value system I had. and didn't have one. So powerless over alcohol, and I went 6 months. I got to Portsmouth, Virginia, and I went 6 months, and I just quit drinking. No program, no sponsor. The only thing I'd ever knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was this sad film called The Days of Wine and Roses, and these alcoholics sitting down in the basement. And I said, well, I wasn't that bad. I was that bad, but that movie to me kept a lot of people away from AA for a long time because of that scene. It kept me back from it. And but I quit drinking. I went 6 months, and I was going to commit suicide about the fourth month. I was going to do it with potassium chloride and get a sailboat. And the coroner doesn't look for potassium chloride because it's in your bloodstream, and physicians like it because you can kind of get double indemnity and make it look like an accident. And it dawned on me that wasn't normal thinking. You know, that's to be thinking about that during the day when you're working in an intensive care unit, taking care of other people who are dependent upon you, is not normal. It's not right. And I went another month, and I happened to stumble into a meeting. They said there's a course on alcoholism for Navy physicians. They've got one opening in California. And I didn't go because I was an alcoholic. I went because I wanted to, it was December in Virginia, and I wanted to come to California. And I got to Long Beach, and I walked in the floor. We were on the seventh floor, I think, fourth or seventh floor there. And you walked out, and you know that song, Lift Me Up Where I Belong? It's just was that feeling. You just walked off the elevator, and the love just poured out there. And I had some model of it being a leper colony or something. And I got to a meeting that night, and it was people that looked like you, just beautiful and radiant. And some of them had been on the windshield of life. Some of them had been in jail. Some of them were running big companies. Some of them were living in the street. But the common denominator was that sweetly reasonable as only the dying can be, because we don't come in here on a winning streak. Very few of us. It's a beautiful day. I think I'll go down and join Alcoholics Anonymous. We come here because it's the last house on the block and the last door to get us. As long as I had any model, I remember being in therapy in Rochester, Minnesota with this psychiatrist who had gone to Exeter and to an Eastern medical school, and he could not comprehend being in the Irving, Texas jail. And he was trying. He just couldn't understand. And there was no way to explain it to him. Neither could I comprehend it. But I'd been there, and I needed somebody to say, well, you know, it's not such a bad thing. But it didn't work. And again, I was trying, and nobody's making any money. I was trying psychotherapy with a good psychotherapist. It just doesn't work. I wish it did. But I came that night into that meeting because I was powerless over alcohol, with many of the examples I've just given you some, but there were more. There always are more. And I made a decision. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity in that room that night, because I saw other people that were just as crazy or had been as crazy as I had, who were happy and joyful and free and loving each other and looked good. And we're living life on life's terms, and getting sick and getting well and getting married and getting divorced and doing it and not whining about it, goddammit. You know, this is that great George Bernard Shaw quote, and I had carried that in my head, and John B. talks about it too. But this is the George Bernard Shaw says, this is the true joy of life. To lose yourself to a cause determined by yourself to be a mighty one. To be used up before they throw you on the junk heap of life. To become a force in the universe rather than a sniveling little clod of grievances, ailments, and insecurities, complaining that the world does not make you happy. And that was me. a clot of grievances, ailments, and insecurities, complaining that my job didn't make me happy. My wife has left me. I have alcoholism. Poor me. You know, a chicken shit way to live. Life is what it was. A big babyism into adulthood, a form of breastfeeding into adulthood. I can't stand it. Glug, glug, glug. I can't stand the way I was treated. Glug, glug, glug. I can't stand my wife. Glug, glug, glug. It's not a coping mechanism, folks, you know. It wasn't for me. And I was so happy to be in treatment because it was the first time in that I'd been in medicine around again, and I had this perversion. I like to take care of folks. And fatal illness that was fatal, that was treatable, I just loved it from the first minute. And I didn't want to come back through treatment. About half the people there, even though that was the best treatment facility in the world. The Navy had the best EAP program in the world, and I'll tell you why it was the best. The Navy's did not ask Dr. Ron Smith my opinion about whether I had alcoholism or not. He said, Dr. Smith, you're going to meetings. You're going to get in the van every night and go out to Long Beach and East Side Open Door and East Bay, come down to Laguna, but you will go to AA meetings. It's not an option. This is the only disease in the world that we ask a sick organ to diagnose itself. You know, did you ever think about that? I didn't know I needed meetings. But it wasn't important for me to know. It was important for the Navy to know. They knew, and they said, you're going. We had 85% recovery in pilots and 80% in physicians. I mean, those are astonishing numbers. And they did it because they made us go. The function of treatment, we forget that. I'm in the treatment business. But the function of treatment is to get people to love AA. It's not to talk about mama and how she didn't pick me up enough. You know. There, there. My poor wounded child. I've got a wounded adult that's trying to come out by God and doing it. So I asked there, the people that did relapse, that were coming back through for treatment. Got a wounded adult that's trying to come out by God and doing it. So I asked there, the people that did relapse, that were coming back through for treatment, what happened? What happened? Why'd you drink again? The answers were two that were very common. The most common was getting away from meetings. For some reason, if we get away from meetings, we tend to drink again, and we understand some of that, and not important to go into it, it's just the reality. If we get a different mindset away around us, we begin to absorb those values and we drink. And people who keep coming back to meetings, I've been doing it for 22 years and I think it's meant more to me this year than ever, tend to stay sober. I really want to stay sober. I don't want to drink again. So I come to meetings. It's easy. Now, the second answer that people tended to relapse was not doing the fourth step. This fourth and fifth step. I don't know why that terrified me, because I'd kind of been doing the ongoing therapy stuff. But it really, you just lay there on the couch and lie to one another. It's not what a fourth and fifth step is. So if you want to save yourself about $25,000 that you're going to have to pay to somebody like me, and it not work as well, get a pencil and paper tonight if you hadn't done it, and write it down. All this tacky stuff about us that we don't want to share with anybody, they're all the same. I've heard 1,000 fifth steps now. Most of us have made love or thought about making love to something we shouldn't have. Most of us have not entirely filed an honest IRS. A lot of us have peed in the pool. That's on my mind today because I was up at the hotel and we're wondering. All this stuff, and I got a pencil and paper and I wrote it down. I got this sergeant major in the Marine Corps named Tim, and he was in treatment about the same time I sat down, and I said, "Well, Tim, this, I did this and I did that." And he listened, and he said, "Well, that doesn't sound like much to me." And while I could not accept myself, this was the shame base in me, when I saw in his eyes acceptance, I could then internalize that, and I could begin to accept myself. And we have to keep doing that. I've done one with Frank, and more than one with Frank. And still, I'll get in trouble, and I'll call. We keep doing it. It's an ongoing process. We don't get done. But by doing the fourth and fifth step, you know, it's not nothing new. It's confess your sins ye to one another, and it goes back before that to a Jewish sect called the Essenes. And the Zen folks, when I went to Kyoto, you go in front of the Roshi and you bow and he bows and you say this and they hit you with a stick. And, you know, it's the same deal. What we do is try to join the human race by acknowledging where we're sinning in the true sense of the old sin, which was not, it didn't have anything to do with good and evil. It's an archery term for how much we're missing the mark. And we share that with another person. Why? Because alone we go crazy. John the Baptist goes crazy in the desert. Any of us that go up into a cave somewhere, we go nuts. We have a biologic need for what's going on in here. I remember when I was a medical school student, they talked about Harlow's monkeys. And Harlow was a guy who got monkeys and watched them, how the mother monkeys treated the baby monkeys. And he let some of them just do the normal monkey thing, and they kind of grew up okay. And the next one were raised by chicken wire. And the next one he didn't pick up at all. He kept them in a bassinet with an excellent diet and a normal temperature and humidity, everything maximized, but he didn't pick them up. He didn't hold them. And what happened to those? They died. They all died. Because if we don't get picked up and held, we don't make red blood cells. They didn't make, their long bones didn't grow. They don't breathe. Now, when I heard that story as a medical student, I said, well, that proves that you need to pick up baby monkeys. And when I walked into my first AA meeting, I knew that I was the monkey. That I was the one that needed to be picked up and held, and I couldn't do it. That's what I was trying to do with alcohol. Put a blanket around me, crawl back in the womb. That's not what it was about. You know, these hugs that we do, and AA people really hug one another. They're not this Protestant, keep your pelvis away crap. Afraid you get germs or something. I've never, a fleeting erotic moment, God forbid. But what something happens when we do that. Our endorphins go up. Our blood pressure goes down. Our red blood cells go up. Our testosterone and estrogen goes up. It's interesting. The biologic response to a hug. And this culture doesn't hug enough. And that's why it comes out in very perverse ways in this culture. Normal, healthy. We don't hug in Washington. Said I work on the Hill and the Pentagon. It's the two largest adult care centers I know. Good people, though. I must say this, that since I've been back, I've never seen so many good people trying so hard. I think we can be very proud of what goes on there by and large. Second best form of government in the world. We just hadn't discovered what the first best is. But we do the fourth and fifth step, and then we look at the stuff, and it's not the stuff we've done, it's the feelings and the neediness behind it. We made love to that person or thing that we shouldn't have because we were so damn needy. Not to be a bad person, to reach out and join humanity. These defects of character, we stole because we didn't think we had enough. Or didn't think we had the capacity to do it and play fair and play even. We list out these defects of character as a result of the fourth and fifth step because they will be revealed if you do enough. And then we humbly ask God to remove them. Why? Because all the Prozac, all the Freudian analysts, and I'm a card-carrying Freudian analyst. I'm really the only psychoanalyst in your government. And if that doesn't terrify you, get with me later. But it doesn't work, does it? You can't psychotherapy recovery. We recover because we reach out to others. And we do the eighth and ninth step because we want to get right with the world. Nowhere did I want to be back in Washington when I went. I'll guarantee you, my life was good here. As good as it gets on the West Coast and I think in the best part of the world. But we were in a war that I thought we needed to fight. And I'll stick by that. And I owed the United States government 2 years for my education. And my sponsor and the guy that I patterned my life after in medicine and my training analyst, all three brother, father figures who loved me and cared about me, all said do the right thing. I couldn't find any space in there. So I got all my stuff in a car and drove to the East Coast. And when I got back, they... by grace, they treated me like the prodigal son. They really did. I've experienced grace in this life that's beyond anything I could imagine. We continue to take inventory. Why? Because we just don't get done the first time. We begin. It's a step to beginning. And we do our 10th step and continue to see where we're, you know, if you're flying a plane from here to Honolulu, you continue to check your course. Most of that black box that's in the thing, most of the time, if you're off to the right, it goes clang, clang, clang. And if you're off to the left, it goes ding, ding, ding. And too high, buzz, buzz, buzz. And too low, zing, zing, zing. 95% of the time, it's making noise. Correcting your course. Well, so does my head. Makes noise. And it means to correct a course. Chuck C. used to sit right on the front row here. And I heard him say it, I'm forgotten whether it was this podium or another one, that swallow, he used to go to Capistrano and watch the swallows return for Venezuela. And he said, they came back the same day, St. Joseph's Day, every year. And... if God puts a computer in a swallow's head that can get to Venezuela and back, what's he got in this one? you know, suffering and pain and anxiety is just God's way of kind of, it's that clang, 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 buzz, 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 move this way. Depression's just a way for me to tell me to get off my ass. I went in, I'm 5 years into sobriety, I went into a training analysis. Stayed in it 10 years. And about the eighth year, I told my analyst that I was depressed. It was a sad case. I hadn't been picked up enough as a child. And he said, "Yes, Dr. Smith, it's true that you're depressed. What I fail to understand is why the hell you pay so much attention to it." Freeing. The most freeing thing that was ever said to me about that. We don't have to pay attention to it. I got to the 11th step and sought through prayer and meditation and to improve our conscious contact with God. And it was touched me. It really did. And I happened about the same time, friend on the front row, remember this, I was back at a meeting at Yale and saw Benson's work on meditation. They had started studying meditation to treat high blood pressure because the blood pressure medicines were so terrible then, caused depression. Hemingway was a victim of a medicine probably called Aldomet. Probably it's that and his alcoholism were too much. But they were trying to find a way to treat blood pressure. And I saw Benson's work, the relaxation response. I saw these EEGs up there, and they change when we meditate. Did you know that? Your brain waves change. Your heart rate goes down. The respiratory rate goes down. The skin resistance goes down. Your endorphins, the own morphine stuff in your body, goes up. Our fear goes away. People who meditate regularly, they don't have the baseline fear. And seeing that, I begin to believe. Then I believe the 11th step. I'm a skeptic inherently, and it's hard for me to do what I'm told. But that, together with I was about at the 11th step, and I said, this works. I got to find out more about this. So I went to India. Told Frank. I said, "Frank, I got to go to India. Find God. It's at the Holiday Inn." And Frank said, "Well, you can go over there, but there ain't nothing over there that ain't right here." But I had to go, and I went to Kyoto and to a Zen monastery where we sat and stared at the floor and bowed and hit each other over the shoulder. And it was wonderful. The Buddhists taught me something. The Buddhists taught me that the cause of all suffering is thinking of self, and the cause of all joy is thinking of others. And where had we heard that in here? You know? Where had Bill Wilson heard that in Ohio when his business deal went through and he knew he was going to drink and he went to the Episcopal priest and he said, "Find me an alcoholic. I need to work with an alcoholic. I must work with an alcoholic because my melodrama is making me drink. And I am no longer tonight interested in my melodrama. It hasn't changed. I am interested in yours. I am interested in your journey. I'm interested in the journey on the hill. I'm interested in the journey on the Pentagon." Why? Because my insanity is God's business. He's got to take care of it because I couldn't. I tried to manage it and I tried to analyze it and I tried to do everything I could. And what I've learned that makes me feel good and feel relatively normal and joyous and free, and my love life is good, and I sleep good, is service. Not a complicated thing. The same thing Bill Wilson said when he was carrying the message, and nobody was getting sober, and he told the psychiatrist, I think it was Tebow, he said, "Well, no, this isn't working." And Tebow said to him, "It's working for you." We carry the message because we have to. Not always because we want to. The 11th step works wonders. People who meditate regularly are not depressed. It's one of those things that's virtually impossible to sit on my stool and do my Hail Mary or the St. Francis of Assisi or Om Namah Padme Hum, whatever. God may not play favorites. They may all work, or the Zen thing, which is just counting your breath. But it's not possible to do that and stay depressed, because that's a process of forgetting my melodrama and listening to God's voice. You know, meditation is just listening. Just listening to where to go next. And I'm a kind of person that likes to talk a lot and do stuff. It's what emergency medicine is. Put chest tubes into people and intubate people and sew people up. And now on my good days, I keep my mouth shut. It's hard for you to believe. But I do. We have to change everything about us in sobriety sometimes. Everything about us. And sometimes at great cost. Almost always by work. You know, we do have to work. It doesn't just descend upon us. And the joy is that we're able and we get healthier and weller than well, and we can work. And we carry the message. We carry the message again just because we have to, not because we want to. And thank God, what a wonderful, simple message it is. You know, don't dream. Go to meetings. Love each other. Get interested in someone else's problems more than your own. And you'll get well. Now, what patient in the intensive care unit with leukemia or cancer of the pancreas or respiratory failure or heart disease wouldn't come to these meetings if you told them that that's all you have to do? They'd be lined up out there. Come early and stay late. I've probably never seen anybody that wouldn't, that had one of those diseases. Yet only 15% of us find our way in here. It's easier to get Congress to vote together than someone to go to an AA meeting. So I feel tonight like the luckiest kid on the block. There's no way. My best efforts got me to the Irving, Texas jail. But I set that aside and began to listen to people who had a lot of what I wanted. I just married the most wonderful woman in the world some time ago, and she's brilliant and she's beautiful and the most difficult human being that I know. She said to be sure and tell y'all that I was a jerk before I left. So I have to carry that message. But she's wonderful, and I miss her. It's the best deal in the world. Catch the disease. Reach out and grab hold of it and love it. And love each other. Thanks for the opportunity to come home and be with you.